dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The innovations in factory agriculture that have been so heavily supported by the government have by and large not been in response to consumer demand, but rather the demand of different sectors of the food production and distribution industry. Foods that will last longer on the shelf, speed up harvest operations, increase output, cut labor costs. This efficiency in food production is generally considered beneficial, but is that true? There is growing concern that these food technologies are creating a variety of health and social problems. Irradiation of food, especially meat, has been touted as a boon to public health, and now irradiated food may be served to millions of school children. People's Tribune Radio reports on this development.
You are tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook. In this edition of PTR, we focus on food products and the current attempt to force irradiated foods on society.
The bottom line is, we don't know what the impacts on human health will be. We certainly don't know the long-term impacts. We don't know how it's going to affect children. School children could be the first population on Earth to be consuming irradiated meats as a substantial portion of their diet. School districts still have the opportunity to decide to not serve this food to the students in their district. And really, these next 4 months are going to be the time to make sure that school districts understand what the USDA is involved with and to ensure that they're looking out for the interests of the kids in their district.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. According to the Public Citizen Food Irradiation Alert pamphlet, the 20-plus million economically disadvantaged students who are participants in the National School Lunch Program might have to eat irradiated meat. Despite opposition from most of the 5,000 people who wrote to the USDA, the federal agency has allowed irradiated meat to be a possible choice for the thousands of school districts within the United States. A small number of schools have actually chosen to use irradiated meat. However, as the USDA develops a pro-irradiated meat campaign, other schools could join in, regardless of children's health and the increase of expenses. To find out more about irradiated food, we spoke with Tracy Lerman of Public Citizen in Oakland, California. Tracy Lerman, what is irradiated food and why is it a problem now?
Irradiated food is food that is exposed to extremely high doses of ionizing radiation, and the radiation destroys bacteria, prevents it from reproducing, and also destroys a lot of the other chemicals found in food. This is a concern because the chemicals destroyed in food are often essential nutrients, vitamins, essential fatty acids, and the process also creates new chemicals, some of which are known toxins and carcinogens, some of which are chemicals that are completely unique and have never before been tested for safety in people. Irradiation is also concerning because with meat production, it's used to destroy bacteria, but it's used as an end-of-the-line process and allows meat packing companies to keep their facilities as unsanitary as they need to in order to produce their meat quickly. So rather than having a clean facility where meat doesn't get contaminated in the first place, irradiation is applied at the end of the line to kill bacteria, but the things that contaminate the food that carry the bacteria in the first place are still in the meat.
I have a general question. Do food irradiation techniques make food radioactive?
No. Meat is not made radioactive by irradiation. In fact, that's an argument that's used by proponents of irradiation. They claim that we say that it makes the meat radioactive to make us sound like we don't know what we're talking about, but meat does not, in fact, become radioactive. But the process, because ionizing radiation is a really powerful form of energy, it destroys chemical bonds, forming what's known as free radicals, and these free radicals meet with other free radicals and form new chemicals, which may be cancer-causing, may be toxic, but mostly we don't really know what this does to people.
Is food irradiation used only on meat or on vegetables and fruit as well?
Irradiation is also used on produce. It is an effective way for invasive insects to be destroyed. So what this means is that produce can be imported from anywhere in the world, and the problem of invasive insects is less of a concern. It also extends shelf life of produce, which again allows it to be imported from all over the world. While this might sound like it's not a problem when you first hear it, it actually is a big problem because it greases the wheels of globalization. It's an expensive technology that really only large corporate agribusiness has access to, and small farmers aren't going to be able to irradiate their food and ship it to markets in other countries. Large corporate agribusiness can irradiate food and ship it to other countries, and this creates or furthers the creation of a corporatized food system that benefits multinational companies at the decimation of small farmers.
We wanted to talk about food irradiation close to the beginning of the school year. Why is irradiation a timely matter at the beginning of this school year?
Well, right now it's an issue because the USDA has recently approved irradiated meat for the National School Lunch Program, which serves somewhere in the neighborhood of 28 million meals a day. So school children could be the first population on Earth to be consuming irradiated meats as a substantial portion of their diet. We think this is unconscionable. Like I said, irradiated meats have really not been adequately tested for safety for consumption by humans, and children of all people shouldn't be the guinea pigs for this technology.
So this year our children are going to go to school and eat irradiated food in their lunches?
Well, actually, irradiated meat would be introduced to the National School Lunch Program starting in January. School districts have the option to buy irradiated meat or to buy regular meat, or not necessarily buy it. It's administered in different states differently, but school districts will have the option to have irradiated or unirradiated meat in their school lunch programs in January of 2004. So school districts still have the opportunity to decide to not serve this food to the students in their district. And really, these next 4 months are going to be the time to make sure that school districts understand what the USDA is involved with and to ensure that they're looking out for the interests of the kids in their district.
Are we talking about every child having irradiated food served to them?
Yeah, the National School Lunch Program is a program designed to provide low-income children with a free or reduced-price meal. And it also provides school districts with low-cost commodities such as meat, cheese, etc., to serve in their school lunch programs. If a school district does decide to serve irradiated meat, a kid who doesn't have to rely on the National School Lunch Program can bring a lunch from home, but there's plenty of kids who really rely on school lunch as maybe their only hot meal of the day. Sometimes kids come in to school on Monday morning without having eaten the entire weekend, and these kids aren't going to have the option of refusing to purchase lunch. That's what they're eating. That's what they get. So it's really unconscionable, again, that the USDA is basically working with the irradiation industry. There's a tremendous revolving door between the industry and the USDA and the FDA to you know, say to the irradiation industry, well, your stuff doesn't sell on the shelves. We're going to give you a huge contract. We're going to give you 27 million meals a day, and low-income kids are really not going to have any other option. It's a huge issue of environmental justice or food justice to say that, you know, if you have money, you can opt out of it, but if you don't, you can't.
Does irradiated food have to be labeled? What about in schools? How will parents know if their kids are eating irradiated meat?
Irradiated food that's sold in supermarkets has to be labeled if the food, the whole food has been irradiated, or if it's a meat ingredient that's been irradiated in a processed food. So, for example, if there's meat lasagna that's using irradiated beef, that has to be labeled. If it's an apple that's been irradiated, that has to be labeled. But irradiated tomatoes used to make tomato sauce don't have to be labeled. And spices also don't have to be labeled if they've been irradiated. However, if it's served in institutions or restaurants, it doesn't have to be labeled at all. So schools have no obligation to tell parents that food that they're serving to school children is irradiated. That doesn't mean that they won't, but they don't have to.
Have large numbers of people ever consumed irradiated meat before?
No. In fact, irradiation is not really accepted by consumers. It's available in a lot of grocery stores in the United States, irradiated meat is, but it doesn't really sell. And in fact, the stock of the company that produces irradiation technology, one of the companies, the Sherbeam Corporation, which is based out of San Diego, has really not been doing so well. It occasionally surges with a new announcement of a new store or something like that, but it's pretty much been dropping steadily. So there's no consumer acceptance of it. There were some studies done in the Army in the 1950s. Previously, the Army had been serving irradiated bacon to soldiers, and then they had done some studies that had shown some negative effects, and they decided not to serve it to soldiers. And NASA has served very small amounts of irradiated food to astronauts, less than 2% of the NASA diet. But with school lunch meat, this is something that kids could be eating 2 to 3 times a week if they purchase lunch at their school district. So this is the first time irradiated meat would be served to a population.
You are listening to People's Tribune Radio. We are speaking with Tracy Lerman of Public Citizen about irradiated meat. Tracy Lerman, what does the research show about food irradiation?
Well, most of the research on the safety of irradiated food has been conducted prior to 1980. So with a few exceptions, there's been very little research done on irradiated food in the past 23 years. In the mid-70s, there was a study done in India using malnourished children who were fed irradiated wheat, and this showed some really negative effects. That study perhaps is questionable to begin with, but just because an American child, the perception is that American children aren't malnourished, doesn't mean that we should be feeding something that caused these problems. And since the 80s, very little research has been done. There was some research done on lab rats in Germany that on some of the unique chemicals formed in irradiated food, and it showed that they may promote cancer and cellular and genetic damage in rats. But the problem with a lot of research in this country is that they don't generally use children subject. In a lot of ways, that's good. We don't want children to be experimented on, and certainly we're not advocating that, but you can't assume that if it's okay for an adult to eat something, that it's okay for a child to eat something. I mean, children aren't mini adults. Their bodies are still developing, and they consume a lot more food and water for their body weight than adults do. So we don't really have a good idea of how children are impacted by a lot of these toxins, and certainly we would say that the precautionary principle is in order here. If we don't know what it does to children, then we probably shouldn't use it until we can ethically and morally find a way to find this information out.
This is interesting. Has the issue been discussed by our government leaders?
It came out of the Farm Bill of 2002. There was a tiny paragraph in this 1,300-page piece of legislation that said that the USDA secretary could not discriminate against approved food safety technologies in the National School Lunch Program and other commodities purchasing program, irradiation being the only approved food safety technology that the USDA talks about. And then in November of 2002, the USDA opened up comments on how this portion of the Farm Bill is to be administered. Well, over 90% of the comments that came in were against using irradiated food in the National School Lunch Program. And 6 months later, the USDA decided to go ahead and offer it. So they essentially went against the will of the people.
One of the issues you recently spoke about is how meat is developed and processed in this country, and why it is that food irradiation is a shortcut to the safeguards that people have worked decades to implement. Could you talk about this a little more?
Yeah, this is a big issue. Over the past 30 years, the meatpacking industry has become increasingly consolidated, and now about 10 companies control about 70% of this industry, which is a $119 billion industry. These 10 companies not only have changed the landscape of the meatpacking industry, but they've also become incredibly powerful lobbying forces in Washington and have very successfully managed to lobby away a lot of the regulations that govern them and also gut the role of federal meatpacking inspectors. There's very little scrutiny over the way meat is packaged and processed in this country. And if you walk into a meatpacking facility, you'd probably be pretty disgusted with what you would see. Not only is meat packaged and processed extremely fast, 400 cattle per hour or 140 chickens per minute is the average, animals are also kept in very cruel conditions. Most animals are crowded into feedlots that are called confined animal feeding operations. They wallow in their own excrement. They are pumped up with hormones and antibiotics. And then they're slaughtered, like I said, extremely quickly. Most of the time, or frequently, it's impossible to keep the things that carry foodborne illness or the bacteria that cause foodborne illness out of the meat. And the things that I'm talking about, they're unpleasant, but it's there. It's excrement, it's vomit, pus, urine. And this gets into the meat. And by irradiating it, yes, you destroy the bacteria that these contaminants may carry, but you don't get rid of these contaminants. You're essentially eating sterilized filth if you eat a burger that's been irradiated. Not only is are the conditions in meatpacking facilities disgusting for consumers, but they're also really unsafe for workers. Meatpacking used to be, it was never a 100% safe job, but it used to be a solid job that was unionized, where workers were paid a decent wage. And with the consolidation of the meatpacking industry, the job has become a low-wage job that mostly employs undocumented immigrants who don't really have the capacity to organize and fight for their rights. A lot of times, the owners of these facilities will threaten to report their employees to the INS if they do try and demand any kind of rights. And the atrocities that happen to workers in meatpacking facilities are really horrific. A lot of really serious injuries, maiming, even death can be caused by working with equipment that's designed to kill a 1,000-pound steer. It's a real problem, and I think the irradiation industry and the meat industry began to join hands when the meat industry had a series of huge recalls, recalling millions of pounds of meat, and then they realized that they could clean up their facilities, which costs a lot of money, and also forces them to accept liability, or they can accept irradiation, which, although it's expensive, is a lot cheaper than cleaning up their facilities and having good labor practices. And they chose irradiation, and they can even market it as a quote-unquote added layer of safety. It's really atrocious. Even if irradiation were totally safe, you're still eating essentially sterilized filth. And I think that's really the thing that has to make us question this technology.
Even if the food was completely sanitized, there are still ways for bacteria to get into meat, for example.
Well, the thing about irradiation is that it only kills the bacteria at the moment that it's irradiated. So you can't leave irradiated meat out on the table for a day. It's still going to form bacteria because not all of the bacteria is destroyed. And in some ways, especially if we're talking about meat that's going to be used in large facilities like school cafeterias or large restaurants, it might even give people a false sense of security. And last year, ABC had an expose on the conditions of school cafeterias, and a lot of them had problems in terms of how unsanitary they were that irradiated meat would do nothing to solve. You have to have a clean facility, no matter how, you know, sterile or contaminated your meat is. You can always cook meat to 150 or 160 degrees to destroy any bacteria, but, you know, you can't have irradiated meat and a clean facility. That doesn't work.
You mentioned the precautionary principle. Could you explain what that is and what it means?
Basically, the precautionary principle is a philosophy saying that until we know what something does, we probably shouldn't use it. I think the modus operandi in this country is that it hasn't been proven, so until we know a chemical is bad for us, we're just going to use it. And we saw this with silicone breast implants, a lot of other things that the FDA had approved in the 50s and 60s, and then retracted their approval when it was found out that maybe some of this stuff wasn't so good for us. And that's the thing with irradiation. The bottom line is we don't know what the impacts on human health will be. We certainly don't know the long-term impacts. We don't know how it's going to affect children. And we don't really know how these chemicals formed are going to affect us, especially when taken in combination with all of the other, you know, thousands of chemicals that we're exposed to on a daily basis. Bus toxins, pesticides, toxins and preservatives in our food. We don't know how all these things work in combination with each other. So certainly introducing a new host of a bunch of different kinds of chemicals into our diet and into our consumption patterns doesn't really make sense and doesn't really follow the precautionary principle at all.
This is PTR, and we are talking about irradiated meat with Tracy Lerman. How can the food industry or meat industry be organized differently in order to have people come first?
That's a really good question, and really irradiation is sort of a way of looking at the food industry. It's a tool for the corporatization, for the centralization of the way food is grown and produced on this planet. But it's not the only way. There are models out there. There's a lot of people out there who produce food sustainably, who raise livestock in a humane way, and slaughter and process it in a humane way that doesn't allow for contamination by bacteria and other things that may make us sick. And the models out there for smaller localized food production systems don't require irradiation because you have a lot more control over the system. If you have operations, a meat packing operation with 20,000 cattle, how are you going to ensure that these cattle don't get sick, that you don't get contaminated meat? Or if you have a meat packing plant that's processing thousands of animals from all over the country, how are you going to ensure that that meat stays clean? Well, you can irradiate it, but, you know, we already know how problematic that is. Or you can make the food system much more decentralized, much more localized, and much more stable and secure. You can employ methods that are more humane, slow it down, don't rely on the use of antibiotics and hormones, let animals live the way that they're supposed to live and move around the way they're supposed to move around and have some respect for the life that you're taking in order to feed yourself. And you don't need to use these components of industrialized agriculture that really only benefit large corporations at the expense of small-scale farmers, producers, and basically everyone who eats.
Is there a history of fighting for clean meat?
Yeah. The meatpacking industry was also at a low about 100 or so years ago. Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, has 10 pages that describe the conditions of the meatpacking industry. You know, that book was supposed to be about labor rights for Polish immigrants in Chicago, and what it wound up doing was completely changing the way meat is packaged and produced in this country. Following that book, the Meat Inspection Act of 1906 was passed, and meat became a lot cleaner in this country. The job was a unionized job that was completely respectable, and it was still fairly decentralized. When we were still an agricultural economy, it was easy to buy beef and know that it came from the farmer that was a couple miles down the road or maybe 20 miles away, but not necessarily 3,000 miles away, or have a package of meat that came from about 1,000 different animals. That wasn't really an issue 50, 60 years ago, and now it is because it's so centralized, because we live in this corporate era. It's really time for us to realize that that system isn't working and that we do need to go back to a much more decentralized local way. And it's also a lot more food secure to get your food from a local source. If we're relying on imported produce from halfway around the world and meat that comes from the other side of the country and cheese that comes from somewhere else that's really far away, think about the possibility for catastrophe that entails. You know, the borders shut down and our food supply is largely imported. Well, what are we going to eat? It's really just makes a lot more sense for us to be eating food that's grown locally, economically and ethically and environmentally. It's just a much more sustainable way to run a food system.
Can you tell our listeners how they can find out information about Public Citizen and more about irradiated meat?
Well, our website has a bunch of different resources on it. That's www.citizen.org/CMEP. That's C-M-E-P. There's also an article that was in the most recent issue of Consumer Reports. So if you go to their website, which I believe is consumerreports.com or .org, type in irradiated meats in the search engine, you can come up with this article. And if you go to the Community Food Security Coalition website, www.foodsecurity.org, you can find out more about promoting the alternatives. So it's not just about stopping the bad stuff, it's making way for the good stuff as well.
And we must continue to support avenues for the good stuff, as Tracy Lohman of Public Citizen described. As long as corporations continue to create our food products with profits on their minds, our health and social livelihoods will continue to suffer. That is it for this edition of PTR. People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the profits gained by a few at the expense of the majority are used for the betterment of humanity as a whole. If you would like to contact the League for a speaker, other print and media resources, or with questions, you may call our 800 number, 1-800-691-6888, or visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook.
Adult onset diabetes is on the rise in America. Native American communities have been particularly hard hit by this disease. Biotech companies are frantically searching for a genetic source and cure, but we need look no further than the general consumption of refined carbohydrates. Native Solidarity News spoke with an Oklahoma journalist who has been following the reasons for this epidemic in Indian country and the implications this has for non-Indians as well.
Hi, my name is Liz Gray, and I'm the founder and co-publisher of the Native American Times newspaper here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I have found myself going down this path of getting information regarding diabetes in Indian country, and it just seems to keep coming, so I've started the nonprofit organization.
Up here we're hearing a lot about the non-native press are always publishing articles on different problems in native communities, whether it's corruption in government or health issues, and it's often portrayed as a kind of a shaggy dog story. And can you talk about what your perspective on the media spin is, and look at what you've actually seen as the real fundamental issues going on here?
Fundamental issues regarding diabetes?
Yeah, why is there such a high rate of diagnosis of diabetes among First Nations people in not only in North America, but let's start there.
Well, one thing I would like to say is it's not only the Native Americans that are becoming diabetic. And pardon me if I say Native American or American Indian. I switch back and forth. There are other minority groups that, when introduced to the Western diet, become diabetic. And there's a book called Western Diseases, Their Emergence and Prevention, written by Dr. H.C. Trial, who followed this Western diet and everywhere it went across the world to various traditional cultures, illnesses followed, and one of them was diabetes. If you look at the American Indian plight, many of them are on economically depleted reservations who they only have a choice in eating is federal food program, which is high in refined carbohydrates and very low in anything healthy. In Oklahoma, a lot of the tribes do have access to other federal assistance programs that let them have fresh vegetables, fresh meat, and that type of thing. But if you're just going to eat refined carbohydrates, you need to remember that carbohydrates are sugar. And it's not taught in very many places. That's simple fact. It's eighth grade science. And many of the food producers and pharmaceutical companies are manipulating the information that gets to the public. And part of that information is to focus on fat. Well, they used to call diabetes sugar diabetes. Now they don't. And because a person focuses on fat, low fat, low fat, they forget to focus on the other aspects of diet, which is carbohydrates.
Right, and excess intake of carbohydrates turns to fat.
Yes, it depends on the carbohydrate. There's complex carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates. If you think about it, where does sugar come from? It comes from a really starchy, low-fiber plant, like a sugar beet, or today's modern corn, corn syrup, or fructose from fruit. They eliminate the fiber and totally concentrate the carbohydrate in that natural product. And that's not the way nature intended. It didn't intend for us to have this super, flood of carbohydrates into our bodies. And prior to this refining process that we do with our foods, we American Indians did not have such a high intake of refined carbohydrates. As a matter of fact, it's pretty much zero. And you can say that the many tribes had corn, but the corn that they had was quite different than today's sweet corn you find in the grocery store. Today's sweet corn has about 40% more starch or sugar than traditional corns did. And those were, we invited a couple of people to our last conference, Return to Your Roots Diabetes Conference, which we plan to have another one in October. And their goal is to reintroduce traditional foods to the tribes. And there are some people, they call themselves seed keepers, and they have kept they have seeds of the original corn plants, that breed, I guess you will, that the tribes use. So that's an exciting aspect. getting back to traditional foods for health. Because prior to 1936, Indian people did not have diabetes. Yes, some of them had more exercise, but no one had diabetes, not even if they had a broken leg or they were immobile or they were elders, especially juveniles. They didn't have juvenile diabetes. So I don't really think the whole answer is that we exercised more in the past. We've got to look at what did we eat.
Well, how did it happen that people who developed these crops no longer even have access to the foods? How did it happen that, let's say, you're living on a reservation somewhere and all there is white flour products? You know, it's and this also is something that is not, as you say, is not just a Native American issue. Traveling around most of the continent, you can't find foods that many cultures for thousands of years have relied on, like grains and legumes, right? How did it happen that food has come to be what it is?
You know, I think if we were to realize that a food can be a drug or can be, if we realize that it's poisonous, we would have a different attitude toward it. But the Indian people at one time did not have access to anything except the federal food program. And that's where you get the fry bread. I mean, shortly after World War II, we were introduced to white flour, sugar, coffee, and, you know, bacon. What can you make of that but fry bread? And today it's turned into a joke. For one reason, I think, is because if you can't do anything about it, then, you know, laugh it off. But when the knowledge is lost of traditions and elders and were influenced by commercials and TV and just habit, I think it's hard to break. That's one of the important issues that we will need to look into, is breaking this habit, because there is a change in the brain when a person eats refined carbohydrates. You get that feel-good feeling. Your serotonin goes up, your insulin goes up, so your energy rises, and it only lasts a short while. That's why you're hungry 2 hours after you eat a donut when you're really not, after you eat maybe eggs or something. And there's a close relationship to hypoglycemia and alcoholism. 88% of alcoholics are hypoglycemic. That's another, I'm not an expert in the field of alcoholism, but there's a Dr. Larson that has written a book called 7 Weeks to Sobriety. If anyone ever wanted to learn about alcoholism and its relationship to food, I would highly suggest you read that book, because Indian people have, they're susceptible to being hypoglycemic, which can help stimulate alcohol addiction feelings. They can be allergic to wheat, which can also cause an addictive reaction to alcohol. They have one less enzyme in the liver to regulate alcohol. And plus, if you're stuck on a reservation and all you have are the refined carbohydrates and no emotional supporting nutrition like essential fatty acids and amino acids that help regulate the brain, then it can cause depression. Your diet can cause depression. And that's one of the things I would like to talk about at my next conference, is get experts in there to talk about how our foods used to support our emotional well-being as well as our physical well-being.
Talking about diabetes in rural and urban Native communities and really non-Native communities as well, our guest Liz Gray of the Native American Times in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has helped give us some background on, in particular, the federal food program, which instituted certain dietary habits, particularly on reservations. He mentioned that diabetes wasn't known in Native United States before the 1930s, and the 1930s is also the time of the Indian Reorganization Act and the institution widespread of the reservation system and the sedentarization taking away people's land. And this is way past the point where government stopped making treaties, and people's ability to provide for themselves was assured. Of course, you know, we've talked on the program before about the deliberate killing off of the buffalo as part of attempted genocide against Plains First Nations. There's just so many issues here that that go beyond that any kind of interpretation that would say that it's some unfortunate accident that there's so much diabetes in Indian country, as people say. So, now, Liz, one thing we didn't do in the first part is actually just talk about a little bit more about what diabetes is, how it affects people's lives, and the life of the community as well.
Now, I'm not a physician, but what I do as a journalist is collect information from experts such as Dr. Walter Willett of Harvard University, Dr. Schwartzbein of the Endocrinology Institute of Santa Barbara. And I wanted to point that out because a lot of people say, well, what expert, you know, why does she have the right to talk about this stuff? And many of these physicians in the outskirts of today's medical arena always refer back to what we were designed to eat physically. And there's a book out called The Paleo Diet that said that the body is most healthy on eating raw nuts and eggs, fowl, types of meat. That, you know, we did eat meat. That's why there's a lot of issue about, well, how come we didn't have diabetes if we ate a lot of buffalo? It's because the buffalo meat does not, free-ranged meat is much more healthier than stockyard cattle. They have access to free-ranging and grasses and things like that. So we've corrupted a lot of our foods. And the essential fats found in fish was also found in buffalo. And it's funny how some of our traditions, such as eating raw liver right when the animal is killed, was for nutritional purposes as well as spiritual purposes. Now we know, nutritionists will tell you, that the liver has a really high content of essential fatty acids and the good fats, omega-3 fats, that our bodies need. Our brain is 60% fat. Our cell membrane is made up of fat. So if you're putting bad fats like hydrogenated oils off the grocery store shelves and French fries and those type of things made out of the bad fat, it can affect our cells. And that's one thing that causes insulin insensitivity, and it causes the sugar to get trapped in the bloodstream. So if your cells are rigid and you're not insulin sensitive anymore, one thing to do is to get back to eating the good fats nature intended, which is kind of hard to find. If you can't get a hold of fresh fish or farm eggs or free-ranged animals, it's kind of hard to find. But also to regulate the sugar that comes into the body. Juice. People think that it's good for us to drink juice, but if you could look back 100 years ago, we didn't drink juice from 5 or 6 or 8 fruits in one sitting. And we didn't drink it year-round. Fruit was seasonal, so our bodies had time to rest from these high bouts of carbohydrates. So there are two different aspects here. One is something called the glycemic index. And it's easy to find on the Internet. And it tells you how fast foods turn to sugar in the bloodstream. And believe it or not, a slice of white bread turns to sugar faster than table sugar. Or cranberry juice raises the blood sugar faster than Pepsi. So it's not all innocent foods out there we're eating. But what they have in common is being processed and refined. So if a tribe is interested in getting the health back of their people, look at what we ate before these refining processes. And I'll tell you, it's all based on money, as usual. If a company can process out the good fats out of a product, such as nuts or wheat, they process out the nutrients, then it doesn't rot as fast because the nature's bacteria doesn't want it. There's no nutrients in it. So it has a long shelf life. Therefore, it's cheaper to store, it's cheaper to ship, and it lasts longer. So there's a higher profit in a high processed food. And that includes the oils on the shelf. They're really high processed in very high amounts of heat in the, many of them hydrogenated oils are processed in the presence of nickel. They're bleached and bleached again, and then they're put in bottles and put on the shelves. It's really a dead product. So a lot of, there are a few tribes out there that are realizing that their people are not getting healthier on these recommended diets, so they're getting back to traditional foods. The Winnebagos are reintroducing the buffalo, and the Haudenosaunee, which is the Iroquois Confederate tribes of New York, were just given some land to grow organic foods on the land, and the Fort Peck are looking into getting back to traditional foods. So there are a lot of people out there that are starting to realize that we once were healthy, let's look back and see what we can do to get back to that state of well-being. And the Intertribal Bison Cooperative work with a number of tribes to try to reintroduce the buffalo to those tribes that had buffalo. Some tribes were gardeners. But.
So you're talking about a situation where not only has food for First Nations and all people been denatured, but again, for all people, it's the food that is eaten in a certain place, most of it comes from somewhere else, and the decisions that get made about how it's grown, how it's processed, get made somewhere else. And if you're talking about specifically reservations, which is a colonial imposed living situation, mm-hmm. That problem is even intensified. One of the threads I wanted to pick up on that you mentioned in the first part of our discussion was about the people doing seed saving, this is something that I'm particularly interested in too, again, because the food issue is something that touches everyone, and it is a planetary crisis. And to talk about, with so many people living in the cities now too, it's easy to forget how basic it is to have land and be able to decide how your food is grown. And, uh-huh. You're talking about organic food, talking about eating liver, but now, if you're talking about a factory farmed animal that's being fed on, other animal byproduct or starch
right.
instead of grasses
uh-huh.
and, all the pesticides grown to make, and
mm-hmm.
that go into that, it's no longer healthy. You really, it's part of the solution is, returning to traditional foods, but it's also how it's produced. And indigenous people have developed all kinds of varieties of crops like beans and corn and so on, like you talk about, that are different from the commercial varieties on the shelves. And a lot of food companies and pharmaceutical companies are really coveting these now as sort of new profit engines. And
mm-hmm.
How is this all going to stop? And people are just going to butt out. And
well, there's one thing that I'm really concerned about is the genetically altering corn and the seeds. And Monsanto is a large company that genetically alters foods and has patents on many of the corn seeds. And to me, that's frightening that a person can own a food product of any kind, that it, and it may grow across the country, and we may no longer have individuals holding their own seeds. And I think it's time for us to have faith in ourselves again, to look at what we knew before, because we, many of us have forgotten, many of us have just took for granted that someone else knows what we need and knows what our diet is. But I've seen diets that are designed around this low fat, totally low fat, not focusing on good fats, and forgetting about the carbohydrates. The American Diabetes Association, I don't know if they still do or not, but they used to have a pyramid, a food pyramid on their website that said eat 6 or more starchy vegetables a day. And it, at the bottom of their food pyramid, it had a picture of potato and bread and pasta, which is a really refined carbohydrate. And that kind of worried me. So I think we need to get back to protecting Mother Earth and protecting those seeds. Because if you think about that traditional seed, it has a its own genetics inside that can grow this plant, grow this medicine, and it holds wisdom. And we've got to protect it from getting lost. And I think we need to get back to protecting Mother Nature and realizing that we are ill because we are not in tune with it anymore. And if we need to raise organic crops that we want to sell, I don't see a problem with that, because the next big industry are organic foods. Many people are becoming leery of these huge food producers that put hormones in the animals and genetically alter different foods. And a lot of people are turning to organic foods, and I believe that it could be an alternative to gaming, that some tribes could look into raising an organic crop and selling it under the name of the tribe, and it could possibly become a success story and also benefit many people.
We're running low on time here, Liz, so I'd just like to invite you to add anything that you would like that we haven't had a chance to talk about.
Well, I was inspired by your call, and I am getting our website ready 2 weeks ahead of schedule. So if everyone would like to look at the website and possibly be interested in coming to our next conference titled Return to Your Roots Conference, it will be in October, but write down our web address, traditionalhealth.org, and it should be ready next week. So people can write their views, write their ideas, and we'll be glad to post them. We're going to do stories on the different tribes and the different things they're doing to take care of their people. So I really am excited about this radio interview, and I appreciate you asking me to come on.
I'm really glad that we had the time to do this, and as you said, to take the time to put words to it. I think it's been very inspiring, and I hope that people listening will check out the website and we'll learn what can be learned from this. I'm going to also give the phone number for the Native American Times, if that's
okay.
All right.
Great.
This is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's 918-438-6548.
That was Liz Gray of the Oklahoma Indian Times speaking with Native Solidarity News in Montreal. Problems related to diet affect more than Native Americans. According to the Center for Disease Control, in 1991, only 4 states had obesity rates over 15% of their adult population. Now it's 49 states out of 50. Americans are getting fatter but not happier, writes the author of an article that appeared in Orion magazine as part of their curmudgeon column, which I guess accounts for the offensive tone of parts of the article. It is, however, very informative, so I decided it was worth reading, in spite of a certain sanctimonious quality about weight and overweight. The author is James Howard Kunstler, and it's titled Big and Blue in the USA. Kunstler wrote, Having just returned from a week in England where, among other things, walking more than 10 yards a day is quite normal, I was once again startled by the crypto-human land whales waddling down the aisles of my local supermarket in search of Nabisco Snackwells, Wow Chips, and other fraudulent inducements to diet by overindulgence in low-fat, carbohydrate-laden treats. And they did not look happy. To say that Americans are shockingly obese is hardly a novel observation. Yet it is discouraging to see so many of your fellow citizens in such a desperate and unhealthy condition, and I'm sure it is even more discouraging to be in such a state. Related to this is the recent disclosure that 1/3 of all Americans are taking prescribed antidepressant medications, specifically the SSRIs of the Prozac family. That's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, including Zoloft, Paxil, and Celexa. That's 1 out of every 3 men, women, and children. The American media routinely regard the scandalous levels of both obesity and emotional distress here with befuddlement and even indignation, as though it were inexplicable and even unfair that such a friendly, generous, valiant, humorous, and enterprising folk as we should be so mysteriously afflicted with the blues. Have any reporters noticed how we actually live here in America? With very few exceptions, our cities are hollowed-out ruins. Our towns have committed ritualized suicide in thrall to the Walmart god. Most Americans live in suburban habitats that are isolating, disaggregated, and neurologically punishing, and from which every last human quality unrelated to shopping convenience and personal hygiene has been expunged. We live in places where virtually no activity or service can be accessed without driving a car, and the usually solo journey past horrifying vistas of on-ramps and off-ramps offers no chance of a social encounter along the way. Our suburban environments have by definition destroyed the transition between the urban habitat and the rural hinterlands. Our homes, as we have taken to calling mere mass-produced vinyl boxes at the prompting of the realtors, exist in settings leached of meaningful public space or connection to civic amenity, with all activity focused inward to the canned entertainments piped into giant receivers, where the children especially sprawl in masturbatory trances, fondling joysticks and keyboards, engorged on cheese doodles and taco chips. We've sunk so much of our national wealth into a particular way of doing things that we're psychologically compelled to defend it, even if it drives us crazy and kills us. Placed in such an environment, even a theoretically healthy individual would sooner or later succumb to the kind of despair and anemia that we have labeled depression, in our less than honest attempt to shift the blame for these predictable responses from our own behavioral choices and national philosophy to some more random disease process. But the misery is multiplied when these very behavioral choices, inactivity, isolation, and overeating sugary foods lead to disfiguring obesity on top of despair. And it must be obvious that I am describing a self-reinforcing feedback loop that generates ever more personal misery and self-destruction. Another way of looking at our predicament is as the result of a high-entropy economy. Entropy being provoked by huge free energy inputs in the form of 100 years of cheap oil, and entropy being expressed in forms as varied as toxic waste, ruined soils, and buildings so remorselessly ugly that the pain of living with them corrodes our souls. Depression, despair and anemia, and obesity are as much expressions of high entropy as the commercial highway strips, the big box stores, the housing subdivisions, the hamburger chains, and all the other accessories of the wished-for drive-in utopia.